From Albany, New York, this is Public Health Radio. Filling in for Dr. Marvin Malik, I'm your co-host, Elaine Hills, doctoral candidate at the University at Albany School of Public Health, Department of Epidemiology, here with my co-host, Andy Coates, practicing physician.
Thanks, Elaine. The United States of America spends more money on healthcare than any other nation. Healthcare occupies a greater portion of the American economy than it does in any other nation, with one of every $6 of the gross domestic product going to healthcare. When population is factored in, the United States spends at least twice as much per capita on healthcare than any other nation. And the majority of spending on healthcare in America comes from government sources, public, not private funds. Yet only a small fraction of total healthcare spending is devoted to public health. Out of every $100 spent on healthcare in the United States, only one or two go to public health. More, this number is likely to decline as deep cuts in funding to federal public health programs have been proposed for the 2007 federal budget. In this edition of Public Health Radio, we ask Dr. Walter Sue, immediate past president of the American Public Health Association, to address the big question of public health in America, beginning with, what is public health?
Public health is defined as what we as a society do to assure conditions so that people can be healthy. Public health is the foundation upon which we build a healthcare system.
Dr. Sue discusses the needs of our public health infrastructure, eliminating health disparities, guaranteeing equal access to healthcare, providing culturally appropriate medical care, among other topics. He offers a compelling vision of the fundamental importance of public health to medicine and society.
But first, some news from the world of public health. More than one quarter of American women in need of contraceptive services and supplies rely on public support, and recently published data from the Guttmacher Institute shows this number has grown between 2000 and 2004. Information compiled by the Guttmacher Institute, with support from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, shows that in 2004 there were more than 66 million American women who were able to become pregnant. More than half of these women were sexually active, but did not wish to become pregnant. Contraceptive services and supplies are thus needed for a group of more than 33 million American women. Of these, more than 17 million American women who were in need of contraceptive services were only able to access those services with publicly funded programs. The number of American women in need of publicly funded contraceptive services between 2000 and 2004 increased by 1 million women. Poor and minority women were disproportionately affected by this change. The number of women in need who were Hispanic increased by 14%. The number of Black women in need of contraceptive services and supplies increased by 4%, while publicly funded contraceptive needs of white women decreased by 2%. Medicaid funding for contraceptive services has tripled since 1980. Medicaid funds now account for almost two-thirds of all federal and state family planning nationwide. One program that continues to receive federal funding under the Bush administration is the development of crisis pregnancy centers. While the mainstream media has devoted a lot of attention to the Bush administration's refusal to provide FDA approval for emergency contraception, commonly known as Plan B, it has devoted little attention to federally subsidized crisis pregnancy centers. In a report released on July 17, the House Government Reform Committee announced that federally funded crisis pregnancy centers have been found to frequently mislead and misinform pregnant teens about the health risks of induced abortion. The report, entitled False and Misleading Health Information Provided by Federally Funded Pregnancy Resource Centers, revealed that crisis pregnancy centers in 15 states were shown to have misled or provided false information to investigators posing as pregnant 17-year-olds seeking advice about unintended pregnancy. Of the 23 crisis pregnancy centers contacted by investigators compiling the congressional report, 20 provided false or misleading information by claiming there is a link between abortion and breast cancer, that abortion harms future fertility, or that abortion increases a woman's risk of suffering severe mental health problems, all of which are contrary to scientific evidence. Crisis pregnancy centers, the report found, engage in, quote, inappropriate public health practice, end quote, despite having received over $30 million in federal funding between 2001 and 2005. Further information on these and other reproductive health news stories can be found at www.guttmacher.org, that's www.guttmacher.org. In environmental health news, the National Research Council recently reported that the industrial chemical TCE, or trichloroethylene, is more likely to cause cancer and other human health problems than was previously thought, a finding that could warrant a substantial lowering of the acceptable levels of TCE allowed to remain in drinking water sources. TCE, a solvent widely found in drinking water in the United States, has been dumped on grounds throughout the country. In Southern California alone, drinking water sources to more than 1 million people are contaminated by TCE. The Pentagon has 1,400 properties that are contaminated with TCE, including Camp Lejeune, a military training base in South Carolina. In 2001, the Environmental Protection Agency attempted to issue a risk assessment, which reported that TCE was 2 to 40 times more carcinogenic than previously thought. But the Defense Department, the Energy Department, and NASA vehemently opposed the EPA's issuance of a heightened risk assessment for TCE at that time. In response to the 2001 controversy over TCE, the Bush administration sent the matter to the National Research Council for further review based on assertions that the EPA had exaggerated the risks of TCE exposure in its 2001 findings. The National Research Council's findings, released on July 27, 2006, supported the EPA's conclusions from 2001. The findings released in July reveal that evidence of TCE risk for cancer was greatest for kidney cancer and rejected the notion that TCE is safe at low levels of exposure. Environmental health expert Dr. Gina Solomon called the National Research Council's new findings, quote, a ringing endorsement, end quote, of the original recommendations presented by the EPA in its 2001 draft risk assessment. The EPA currently limits TCE levels in drinking water to 5 parts per billion. Given the National Research Council's recent findings, that level could be lowered to as little as 1 part per billion, according to an analysis by the Air Force. While such a substantial decrease in allowable levels of TCE in drinking water would drive up cleanup costs by billions of dollars throughout the nation, it could also save thousands of lives. In urban health news, food deserts of America's largest cities are found popping up around the country. We've all seen these areas of America's cities, but not all of us suffer the consequences of living in them. What are food deserts, you ask? They are swaths of American cities filled with fast food restaurants, but lacking in grocery stores, areas where food choices are limited to the unhealthiest foods of all. A recent study of food deserts in the Chicago area concluded that residents of food deserts are more likely to die prematurely from diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and other ailments. More than 500,000 Chicago residents live in food deserts, while about 400,000 Chicagoans live in areas with an imbalance of food choices, making it more difficult to find an apple instead of a candy bar, a salad instead of French fries. Overall, the study showed the worst food choices were available in predominantly African American neighborhoods. In a typical African American neighborhood in Chicago, the nearest grocery store is about twice as far away as the nearest fast food restaurant, which makes following dietary recommendations more difficult for African Americans than for others. The effects of this are not small. 11 out of every 1,000 people in neighborhoods with the worst food access die of cardiovascular disease, compared with fewer than 6 out of every 1,000 people in neighborhoods with the best food options.
Dr. Walter Sue is the immediate past president of the American Public Health Association. He spoke to us on August 8, 2006, from his home in Philadelphia, where he is presently consultant in public health on national questions of public health, as well as a visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Walter Sue, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Sue, how would you define the practice of public health?
Well, public health is defined as what we as a society do to assure conditions so that people can be healthy. So every time we ask people, for example, to buckle up before they drive or wash your hands or not smoke in restaurants, things like this, these are all things that we do to help assure conditions so that people can be healthy. If you think about it, even how we finance healthcare is one of the things that we do as a society to assure people can be healthy. And so from that perspective, public health is very, very broad. It's actually the foundation upon which you build a healthcare system. And you really can't do primary, secondary, or tertiary care medicine if the public health infrastructure is not in place.
In our society, it strikes me that this is not a dominant conversation topic.
Well, that's true. It's not. And yet, surprisingly, a lot of the news stories really do touch on public health, but they don't really mention it. And the truth is that we don't teach health professionals enough about public health, because if they understood more about it, let's say in medical school, nursing school, and so on, they would realize that understanding the foundation upon which you build a healthcare system, like public health, is essential for you to do your job. For example, having clean air, clean water, nutritious foods are things that we take for granted. Someone actually does a lot of work to make sure those things happen. But the fact that we sort of take it for granted means that we sort of ignore it, that part of public health. But I can assure you that, for example, when we had Hurricane Katrina and they closed the Charity and Tulane University hospitals, it was really because the whole public health infrastructure fell apart, and there was no clean air, clean water, nutritious food, or anything available in the aftermath of Katrina. And even though they had all the high-tech equipment in the world, they could not actually manage providing any care because the basic public health infrastructure had collapsed.
That's a very striking example. In our society these days, disaster preparedness and crisis preparedness is very much in the discussion. But yet, when will we talk about the very fundamental things that you're talking about, clean water and a good food supply and the basis for everyday life, really?
Right.
But we don't think about that as health, is your point.
Well, we don't think about it enough in health. And the truth is that we take public health for granted at our own peril, because not surprisingly, if in fact we don't spend enough money to do those areas around clean air, clean water, nutritious food, financing of health care so that people can get access to health care, if we can't do some of these basic public health issues, we see disasters as consequences from that. And at a time when the United States healthcare system is the most expensive healthcare system in the world by many dimensions, we really can't afford to continue not investing in prevention and public health and putting all our money in the tertiary treatment end, assuming that if we treat all these illnesses, we're doing something good. The truth is that we would do something even better and much more cost-effective if we invested in prevention and public health right from the very beginning.
Do you know what percentage of the spending goes to the type of preventive and public health endeavors that you're pointing to?
Well, you know, in our healthcare system, we spend about $2 trillion a year, which is stunning if you think about it. Of that, we spend somewhere estimated between 1% to 3% on basic public health stuff. So that is to say, 97, 99% of our healthcare dollars go to the treatment end, only 1% to 3% of it, depending on which statistics you use, is actually spent on basic public health. For example, you know, out of the $2 trillion, the entire CDC budget is around $8 billion. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, I agree, but it pales in comparison to what we spend on the treatment end of our healthcare system. And I think that that's a skewed priority. We need to spend a lot more money for the CDC and for other agencies that are involved with basic access to primary care services so that we can save our money at the treatment end of care.
What's happening these days in Washington? I understand that the 2007 budget process is well underway.
It is underway. In fact, it's a very crucial time right now. Right now, there's the August recess, and members of Congress are at home. They're getting ready, of course, for the November elections. But this is a time when people can talk with their congressional leaders. You know, they're very concerned about health care. And I think that we as a nation need to spend a lot more money on public health, as I said. Now, just to give you an example, at every health department in the country, they have something called the Prevention Block Grant. The Prevention Block Grant actually funds some of the basic emergency funds for state health departments. Things like it pays for chronic disease prevention, it paid for the West Nile virus when it came in to America. It pays for some places tuberculosis medications or things that they often have difficulty funding from other sources. And that grant is going to be zeroed out under the president's budget. That's going to be totally eliminated. There's other things like the state health planning grant that actually is used for planning for how we improve access to health care at the state level. That program is going to be zeroed out. The rural health grant for planning around rural health issues, that grant's going to be zeroed out. All these grants that are being used to help improve our public health infrastructure are going to go by the wayside in this current administration's budget. And I think that most people don't realize until it's too late what the possible consequences are if these budget cuts go through.
What would it look like to have a public health system that prepared for disasters and epidemics?
Well, that's an essential and a very important question. If we really have the funding at the local level that we need at local health departments to be fully prepared for emergencies and disasters, we have to recognize that it's not just what I would call the police department or fire departments that handle disasters. There are bona fide public health emergencies that are truly the domain of local health departments. For example, when there's chemical poisoning that happens in the waters, or maybe if there was a biological outbreak, some type of infectious agent out there, the first people to call are not necessarily the police and fire departments who have little experience dealing with infectious agents. It's really the health department that has the frontline responsibility. And yet, we don't give the health departments the kind of resources and money, and they don't get the type of attention on the news, the local news channels, that the fire and police departments get. And so the public has a misperception, if you will, that local health departments are somehow adequately funded to do this type of work, and they're not. The truth is that most studies have looked at this, most local health departments would be really overwhelmed quickly if we had a true infectious disease outbreak or a bioterrorist event that were to happen to our local communities. And that's not a sufficient answer. We need to have a lot more resources given to the local health departments, more nurses so they can immunize people to prevent illnesses, more workers to go out to educate people around the risks that are available, that are out in their communities. And if we don't do something like this, we do this at great peril to the public health in each of our communities.
Walter, I understand that you give a talk about access to health care, and you ask the audience the question, what is the health policy of the United States of America? How do they respond, and how would you like them to respond?
Well, I ask the question, what is the health policy of the United States of America, for a reason, because most people, and this is not just the lay public, it's doctors and health professionals who work every day in healthcare. They all look puzzled, and they all look at me and they say, and usually there's this sort of pregnant pause, and they say, well, we don't have one. That's how they respond. And then some people say, well, if you have money, you get health care. Isn't it strange that no one actually asks the question, what is our health policy? If you're a corporation, almost the first thing you learn when you join a company is, this is our mission statement. This is what we stand for. These are our values. This is what we care about. This is why we're in business. We don't even talk about that in our healthcare system. We don't know what our mission is. We have no idea what our values are. And if you are willing to spend $2 trillion in a system that you have no idea what your mission is, what your values are, you have a recipe for waste, fraud, and abuse. And that is the American healthcare system. We have the biggest system of waste, fraud, and abuse because we don't know what our mission is. We need to have a clearly articulated health policy that everyone in this country can understand and subscribe to. And in my mind, that means quality, affordable health care for every American. And if that's your mission, and that should be our mission, then we have to figure out what is the best way of providing that financing to achieve that goal. And in my mind, and in almost every scientific study that's looked at it, the best way to do it is a properly financed national health insurance program. That's why I talk about it, because if you understand what your mission is, it's much easier to come up with how we're going to get there and what our solution should be.
Sometimes when I'm meeting patients and trying to guide them through the hospital or trying to arrange testing or consultations from the clinic where I work, it seems that we have to jump through the hoop of the money. Who's going to pay for the procedure? Who's going to pay for the admission? Who's going to pay for the x-ray? So how will we begin to tackle this as a society?
Well, you've certainly touched on one of my pet issues, I have to say. By every dimension, the American healthcare system is a walking disaster, and it's actually about to collapse, or it's collapsing in front of us. It's not that the delivery system doesn't try to provide the best care, and every physician, you know, who's ethical tries to provide best care regardless of ability to pay. But the truth is that you can't actually practice in America nowadays, as you note, without actually doing a wallet biopsy before you actually do the biopsy. You actually have to figure out what their insurance plan will cover before you're able to actually decide what to do. And I think that actually is a serious problem. You know, there was an article many years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine called Healthcare Rationing Through Inconvenience. And the whole point of the article was that we make doctors go through so many paperwork hoops in order to get the type of care you need that we essentially ration healthcare by putting more paperwork obstacles in front of doctors in order to provide the care they need. We shouldn't create a system that's so cumbersome and so bureaucratic. And, you know, people always criticize what I would favor as a solution, which would be a single-payer national health insurance program that's properly financed and available for everyone. The one advantage, clearly, right from the start, is that it provides universal coverage for everybody in this country. And most studies that have looked at this will say that the most cost-effective way of providing universal coverage for everybody is through a single-payer system. But we haven't had the political willpower to figure out how we get there. And most of the politicians are afraid to actually take the courageous steps of saying, you know, I believe that this, after all these studies, that we ought to do a single-payer system for this country. If we had a single-payer system, then some of the issues that you faced in the hospital about how do we, provide care for all the patients that we're seeing actually disappear, because you really provide the tests and care based on what the patient needs and not necessarily what the insurance company dictates.
Lately, among politicians across the country, the cry of access for all has gone up. There was a huge celebration that Massachusetts had solved the question of access. What's your take on the current political process with respect to access?
You know, it's a mixed bag. Those people who are very poor and below 300% of poverty, let's say in Massachusetts, either get subsidized health insurance, private health insurance, either for free or on a sliding scale. If you're over 300% of poverty, then you are mandated by July of 2007 to actually purchase private insurance. That means that if a person who makes $27,000 a year, let's say, is going to have to come up with the $8,000 to get a decent health care plan in Massachusetts, it's unlikely that you would, if you only made $27,000 a year, that you could come up with $5,000 extra to come up to pay for your health insurance plan. So whether it's even realistic to mandate private insurance like this is a hard question. But the more fundamental question that most Americans don't fully appreciate is the overhead that goes with private insurance. Most private insurance plans take somewhere between 14 to 25% right off the top, which they keep internally. And that means that much of the money that you pay in premiums is not even going for medical care or health care. It's actually going to pay all the workers at the insurance companies. A more efficient system, like a single-payer system, let's say in Medicare, where only about 3% of the money is actually spent on administrative overhead, means that 97% of the dollars gets to go toward medical care. By Massachusetts requiring you to invest in the private insurance marketplace means that you're actually buying into the more inefficient way of providing and paying for medical care. It would be much more efficient if Massachusetts had a single-payer system where maybe the overhead could be 5%, but certainly much more efficient than the current 14 to 25% overhead that they're forcing people to buy into. And I think that when people start understanding more of how inefficient the private insurance industry is, they would, I think, want to demand a better value for their money. And one of the reasons why the American healthcare system is so expensive and seems to buy so little is because we put our money in the private insurance industry and we haven't actually embraced the idea of doing a single-payer plan, either at the state or national level.
Do you think that these programs can begin to tackle the question of disparities? Different populations have different quality of care, different access to care.
Different groups do have different accesses to care right now. And I think actually that's one of the problems with our current system is that we spend a lot of our bureaucracy figuring out who's eligible for which programs and whether you fit in the right category. I mean, if you had to invent a worse healthcare system, you couldn't have imagined anything worse than what we have now. So, for example, if you're very poor, if you're elderly, if you have end-stage renal disease, if you have certain diseases like maybe HIV, or if you have breast or cervical cancer screening needs, you can fit into a certain program. But if you don't fit into one of these disease categories, you're out of luck. And I actually think that, you know, access to care should be available to everybody, and it should be not based on a disease process or whether you're a certain age category or you're a Native American Indian or whatever, it should be dependent on the fact that you need care. And it's based on need and not based on some type of category that you happen to have a group that lobbied very effectively for you. That politicizes the system too much. A universal healthcare system should be much simpler, and basically, if you can fog a mirror and you breathe, you should get in the healthcare system. That's the way it should be.
After a short break, we'll be back with more of Dr. Walter Sue on Public Health Radio. You've been listening to Dr. Walter Sue on Public Health Radio. Dr. Sue is the immediate past president of the American Public Health Association. In part two of our interview, Dr. Sue discusses disparities in healthcare, the need to provide culturally appropriate medical care, the public health infrastructure, and issues a passionate call for engagement for the advancement of public health. I asked Dr. Sue to discuss the question of health disparities.
I've heard the word disparity. For example, Asian Americans die more frequently of cancer than the population as a whole.
The issues around Asian American health are even more complicated. I mean, just imagine how difficult it is to figure out how to get access to health care for people who speak English and are, you know, native-born in this country and so on. I mean, even if you have good insurance, it's often difficult to get the kind of care you need. Then compound that if English is not your first language, so you can add that additional difficulty on there. And then you can think about some of the other cultural elements about trying to provide care for individuals. A lot of Western medicine is not something that many people from Asian countries fully understand and appreciate. And to the extent that we can actually hire or employ bilingual and bicultural individuals, not just Chinese or Asians, but maybe Latinos, people from other countries who are familiar with the American healthcare system, but also can speak other languages, that would go a long way to trying to improve our healthcare system, I think, in general. We need to rethink about how we do our admissions process in America, I think, to medical schools and nursing schools so that we can have more bilingual, bicultural health professionals working in our fields. And we need to try to make sure that the type of ways that we can explain what's going on in healthcare can be improved. I'll give you a story. You know, my wife is a kidney specialist, and you know, there are two kidneys in the body. And so this Chinese guy was in the hospital, and they were explaining to him something about his kidneys, and they drew two ovals on a piece of paper and said that they were going to do some operations on these ovals. And, of course, he didn't understand this term kidneys. And when he asked my wife, who spoke Chinese, why are they operating on my lungs? She had to explain to him that they weren't talking about his lungs, they were talking about his kidneys. I mean, these are the kind of misconceptions that people have if you don't have people who are bilingual and bicultural helping to provide care for you, and what the kind of confusions people have in terms of providing better care. We need to do a lot better job. And for all the money we spend on healthcare in this country, language access and being bilingual, bicultural is one of the worst examples of failures, I think, in our healthcare delivery system. what we ought to do in general is to rethink who we admit to medical schools. There are many high-qualified individuals who come to this to schools who are bilingual, bicultural, and we ought to be asking that in our admission criteria, and we should be giving preferences to people, I think, who come from these neighborhoods and want to go back and work in these neighborhoods and can speak different languages. I think that would actually enhance our healthcare system tremendously.
Well, I have to applaud that. That's a marvelous statement.
You know, there's a lot of movement nowadays about talking about health disparities. At the public health level, a lot of people think that it should be centered at the local health department or state or federal health departments. But the more you think about health disparities in terms of what are the why, for example, is the black infant mortality rate 2 to 3 times that of the white infant mortality rate? And what can we do about that? Access to care, obviously, is one of the major issues, but it's not the only issue. There are whole issues around how, for example, African Americans are treated in America in terms of their opportunities for jobs, for education, for housing, for transportation. All of these things, I think, play into improving the health disparities. These areas like jobs and housing and transportation and education are called the social determinants of health. So that it says that even if we had universal coverage for everybody and everyone had equal access to health care, we would still see health disparities. And in fact, that's been shown in countries like Canada or England where they have universal coverage. There are still disparities among different races. It's until you really have true equal opportunities for these social determinants of health that you can actually do something about eliminating disparities. But if you think about it, that actually defines the domestic agenda of a nation. Things like jobs and housing and transportation and education. They're not just health department issues. They're issues that lie at the highest level of an elected leader's government. At the president's level, the governor's level, the mayor's level. That's the level in which you have to really think about eliminating health disparities. And in fact, in my mind, it would be wonderful if one day the State of the Union address, the president of the United States gets in front of the nation and says, the domestic agenda of my administration is the elimination of health disparities. Because for him or her to say that, would mean that they actually understand that not only are they involved with trying to do something about access to health care, but they also want to make sure that there's opportunities at the jobs, at education, at housing, at every level of the domestic agenda of their administration. That's the kind of attitude you need to really eliminate health disparities. It has to be at the very highest levels. It has to be the concerted effort and the mission, if you will, of what government should be about. I think that if we actually had a government that was dedicated to the idea of eliminating health disparities through a domestic agenda, and it came from the president's level, we would transform in many ways how we think about government itself, and we wouldn't be so cynical about it, and we would be applauding the things that we're doing to make sure that everyone in this country, the kid from Harlem and the kid from, you know, from the richest part of Manhattan, had the same equal opportunities to the richness of and variety of what this nation can offer. That's what we need to do if we want to get serious about eliminating health disparities.
And yet, there's an effort to privatize the healthcare system.
I agree. One of the things that we have to be clearer about is that some essential services that we depend upon probably should not be privatized. And yet other things that are not essential government services, I don't mind if they get privatized. That actually is the big national debate about what should be privatized and what should not be privatized. And I'm of a believer that there's a balance. There are some things that are essential government services, like public health, that are unique for as a government function. And there are other things you know, like selling automobiles that are much better that the private sector do something like this. So in the healthcare field, the big debate, of course, is health insurance. Is health insurance a market commodity or is it a public good? And right now we treat healthcare as a market commodity, which is sold to the highest bidder. And I think that we do that at the great detriment to the American people. If we revamped and rethought about healthcare as a public good, and we saw that as a public good, we would finance it like we finance other public goods like national defense, like sewer and water treatment programs and environmental protection. And we would fund that through tax dollars, and we would use those tax dollars in a more efficient fashion to provide benefits for everybody, not just those who have the ability to pay.
One of the things that we assume is that to do public service, there would be an infrastructure in which to perform that service.
You know, one of the problems, actually, is that we as a society are getting older. And that's also true for the people who are health professionals in the public health workforce. We know, for example, and the public knows, that there's a nursing shortage in this country. But what they probably hear less about is that there's a growing physician shortage in this country. And in fact, there's a whole health professional shortage as we get older. A lot of the people who are providing care today are going to retire in the next 10 to 15 years. And there needs to be a whole new crop of individuals who replace them. That's, you know, has some political cachet. What people don't fully appreciate is that's also true for the public health workforce, the people who work in local health departments, who actually do disease investigations, who inspect your restaurants, who monitor your air quality, who inspect your water to make sure it's actually safe to drink, who actually provide the nutritious foods that are put on the table and investigate food safety issues. All those type of individuals actually are going to be retiring soon also. And we have very little public discussion about trying to replace the public health workforce. And we do that at great peril because I can tell you all we need is a few outbreaks, foodborne outbreaks, that are deadly. And we will have a real question about whether we have enough manpower to do the types of inspections necessary to protect the American people. We need to have the same serious discussion that we have for health professional shortages. We need to have that with the public health community and the public health workforce. And that discussion needs to happen right now. So one of my other pleas is that we start investigating more money in helping to train the next public health workforce generation. Now, I should mention here again is one of the politics. The training grants for the public health workforce in the president's budget has been zeroed out. There's no money for training for the public health workforce. There is actually huge cuts that are going to happen in all the training grants for health professionals. And this is, I think, really penny-wise and pound-foolish. It's not really planning for the future, and it would do this at great peril to our entire healthcare infrastructure.
If we were to plan for the future for the public health workforce with respect to needs, it would seem to me that we would expand it greatly. The patients who I see in the hospital who are elderly and frail frequently go to nursing homes when their care needs could be met at home if we had the caregivers to send to their houses.
Absolutely. We actually need a lot more public health nurses and nurses in general, homemakers, community workers who could be helping the elderly as they get older, live in their own homes. But we don't see training in those areas or enough training in those areas. And that's a serious problem for us. We sort of let the marketplace decide. If you let the marketplace decide, everybody's going to become, you know, stockbrokers and lawyers, and there'll be nobody around to take care of us as we get older, and we'll really have a crisis on our hands. We need to be a lot smarter about this.
How would someone learn more about this question of the public health workforce?
Well, a lot of people need to learn more about public health in general, but one of the ways that you learn more about this is you actually can go to the Association of Schools of Public Health website, asph.org, and that website has a whole section around what is public health and how do I get involved with getting public health training. And you can learn more about how to do that at that website. And there are both schools and programs of public health training that are happening. One of the good things that out there is that there are many, many more programs out there training in public health than ever before. So we're hopeful that we'll get more people working in public health in the future.
Do you think that there was a politicization of this public service that didn't used to be there?
Absolutely. There's a huge politicalization of public health. If you were to ask anyone who works for the federal government about speaking in public, they have to have their speeches cleared by some bureaucrat in the White House or in Washington before they can actually speak in public about things. And I mean, that's the kind of scrutiny that they're going through right now. And before a lot of people who work for the federal government can speak out loud, they have to start with a disclaimer by saying that the opinions I am about to express are my own and do not necessarily represent the current administration. But one of the dangers out there, and you may have seen this story about one of the NASA scientists who was speaking out about global warming, and he had his whole speech edited and by a person who had no scientific background at all and basically denied any references to global warming in his speeches. And the guy finally said, this is ridiculous. I'm being muzzled by the administration about global warming. I can't even speak about this in a scientific forum. And he went to the New York Times and talked about how he's been muzzled. Of course, you know, they finally fired the guy who was editing his speeches, and I think they've allowed him to speak now about global warming because the evidence is so overwhelming. But the truth is that this administration in particular has been very, very muzzled in terms of what they're willing to say in public. If you were to ask the heads of any of the CDC or HRSA or any of the public health agencies, they always say publicly that they support the president's budget. But behind the scenes, I can tell you, they are livid with the kind of cuts they're having to face in their budgets because they realize that, you know, this is a time where we should be investing more money in public health and public health preparedness and not less. These are serious problems with the politicization of public health.
It seems to me that science depends on an open process, and the more minds that participate, the better. So is it possible that this is endangering the scientific process of public health?
I think that the facts speak for themselves, and I think that scientific inquiry should demand that we ask ourselves, as example, why is it that a black baby in America has 2 to 3 times higher risk of dying than that of a white baby? What is it about our society that allows that to happen, and what should we do about that? Now, that part, actually, I personally think the infant mortality statistics should compel us to do something about that. That's simply unacceptable in any other situation for the richest nation in the world. And yet, we are unwilling to move on universal health care. We're unwilling to actually improve the equal opportunities for all races, for the richness of American life. And I think that's one of our problems. We need to really rethink what we can do about improving that type of atmosphere. And in the era of reproductive health, as an example, there are huge political issues that are overwhelming scientific inquiry. This recent whole discussion about Plan B, which is a contraceptive that could be given to help prevent pregnancies, is totally embroiled in their whole reproductive rights politicalization. The scientific evidence would say that we should sell it over the counter without any problems. But because of the politicalization of this, we have had great difficulty of trying to even get Plan B to the market. This may change hopefully soon, but you know, it's still still many, many years later than where it should be.
One of the things we haven't talked about in this interview is a global perspective. And I don't know if you want to say a few words.
I'll say a few words, which is that when the richest man in the world, Bill Gates, who could invest his money in anything he could possibly want, decided that the biggest bang for his buck was to invest his money in global public health, finding immunizations for AIDS, for malaria, for finding treatments for tuberculosis. These basic global public health issues is probably where we could get the biggest bang for our buck as a society. And Bill Gates has realized this, and I think there are important lessons for all of us. We talk a lot about how we want to help other countries. One of the best ways we can use our foreign aid money is to invest it in public health, in the public health infrastructure of developing countries. And I think that is something that we should be investing our money in. The great thing about public health, it's true in America, it's true in other developing countries, is it's probably the best bang for your buck. It has tremendous payoffs down the road. If you can guarantee clean air, clean water, nutritious foods, you can build a healthier society, and hopefully those become important economic partners for this country as we improve our global trade and economic prosperities, not just for our country, but for other countries too.
Who are your heroes in public health?
That's a hard question to answer, let's put it that way. My heroes are people who actually are willing to challenge the system for the betterment of everybody. And I'll start with one of the most famous public health surgeon generals, Dr. C. Everett Koop. Dr. Koop, actually, who came from Philadelphia, I should mention, was actually not a very popular choice among the public health community. He was a pediatric surgeon. It was guessed that, you know, he doesn't know a whole lot about public health. But he was a quick learner, and I have to say that I may have been originally critical, but I'm very happy to say that he turned out to be someone who challenged the Reagan administration at the time when HIV was first coming to America, saying that we need to inform more of the American public about the dangers of HIV and what they need to do to protect them. Well, he was doing this during the Reagan administration, which was very opposed to talking about anything to deal with sex, condoms, drug abuse, or anything like that. And he courageously went public about some of his feelings about this, and he convinced the administration to mail, and it's still to this day the largest mailing in U.S. history on a public health topic. He mailed to every household a whole brochure about what HIV is and AIDS is and what you can do to prevent it. And he was very forthright about his opposition to the very administration he worked for in their quiescence about HIV. And I think, you know, for that, he should be a hero because he, you know, when you go against the hand that feeds you, that's hard. That's very courageous to do that. And it's particularly courageous when you're in a prominent position like the Surgeon General. There are a lot of health officers every day who do not get the publicity that they deserve, who are fighting on a daily basis for trying to protect the public's health. And I think all of them are little heroes. The common situations are restaurants that are, you know, putting out food that's not sanitary or clean, and in the face of an epidemic or outbreak, are opposed to having their restaurant closed. And you have to admire those health officers who, on a daily basis, close these restaurants in the face of tremendous opposition in order to protect the public's health. those guys are heroes, and there are a lot of heroes who work in public health who are unsung, if you will.
Walter, if a high school or college student came to you and said, "That's my calling. What you've just outlined sounds just what I want to be part of," what would you recommend that they do?
Well, I actually have a favorable impression about politics. I think that politics has both bad aspects, but potentially good aspects. And I would urge that person to, you know, work for a while and really get a feel for what life is like from the grassroots level, you know, work your way up in some type of industry that you care a lot about, and then run for office someday and use the lessons about having once been poor and now maybe using that to help better the lot of other people so that they can have the same opportunities that you got. Use that political willpower, if you will, to do something good for this country. Public service, you don't have to be necessarily a politician, but public service has been undermined and denigrated by too many people in this country. There are far more people working in government today who really, truly want to make a difference and want to do something good. But we have political leaders who believe that government is the enemy on everything and and we've become very cynical about government. And so people who are really good don't want to work in government or provide public service. And I think that's to the detriment of our nation in general. We ought to reinvigorate the idea that there is a higher calling in public service that could be good. And we need to provide the rules and regulations to allow people who want to do good to do those things and provide better services for our country. So that's what I would tell a young person.
Dr. Sue, thank you so much.
Well, Dr. Coates, thanks for asking me to be one of your first guests.
Thank you for listening. Your public health radio host, Dr. Marvin Malik, will return in the winter. We wish Dr. Malik well in his candidacy for Lieutenant Governor of the state of Vermont. In the meantime, for my co-host, Elaine Hills, this is Andy Coates, thanking you for tuning in to Public Health Radio. If you missed part of today's show, or if you'd like to listen to a Public Health Radio program that has already aired, please visit publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thank you.